If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
Well, welcome to Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair. What's it all about? Well, this show's all about what unites us. There's too much damn difference going on. There's too much division. There's too much separation, as if we're all a bit of this and a bit of that, and we should be threatened by each other. I'm interested in hidden gems and unsung heroes. Now, Alfred, you're not exactly an unsung hero. You're probably well known to lots of folk. But, you know, what I'm looking for in this show is to talk to people whose life has been, or large chunks of their lives, have been about others, have been about serving, giving, all the stuff that makes real communities tick and families tick. And I want to learn from people who I know give a lot. And man, you've given a lot, Alfred. Could you start off by giving the listeners like a 30-second thumbnail sketch of your whole life? Probably some of them know you, but for those that don't know you, give them a quick run through, like a one-liner for every 10 years. And welcome, by the way, welcome.
Well, thank you. Kia rana tātou katoa tō rama tō tētua. Greetings to everyone, and thank you, Jerry. What a wonderful privilege it is to be able to be with you this morning, and just to be able to share and talk and thoughts and reflections. I just think it's so significant. So who am I? I was born in the year of 1966 in Auckland to parents who came from the Cook Islands. So I'm first generation of Pacific migrant parents, and we lived in Ponsonby, because that's where the migration happened after Second World War, labour shortage, the borders to Pacific opened. And so many of our people came through that doorway and that border to be able to come and fulfil, you know, the needs and the demands, working in factories. And so my dad was a labourer working on the wharves for Farnsworth. My mum was a cleaner working in the post office as well, an intercontinental hotel. You know, they came with the hope and optimism of a future for their families and for themselves. My grandmother was Jewish, and so we had this combination in our house in Ponsonby, 142 John Street, three-bedroom house, outside toilet, no running hot water, 12, 14 people in the house, but we never, ever felt poor. Every day was a day to think about it, to discover, to be able to explore, to learn, and we never felt the victims of poverty. In fact, we felt like we were living a life of opportunity. And so that was really important. And if I think about the three things I was raised with, was about faith, was about family, and was about the future. And that's how I would sum that up. And so from there, at the age of eight, we went out to West Auckland on a Whenuapai bus. Our mother took us out there, you know, bought a house when you could capitalize your welfare benefit for your children. There was an opportunity governmentally where you could do that, and they bought a house out in West Auckland, and then we were raised schooling and so forth out there, and it was a great opportunity. That's where I met my beautiful wife, and so we got married in 1987. I was an electrician by trade, but also to faith was about also how we could serve and connect to our community as well, both practically, spiritually, and even emotionally. So went to Bible college, did a theological degree, went from there out to East Auckland, where we both set up a trust and worked in community, and probably one of the toughest communities in the whole of New Zealand. People don't often see it because Glenlinnis and Pamia are surrounded by communities of affluence. And so out of there, we learned so much from the community of what they gave to us, even more than what we gave to them. And it was a wonderful time, raised our four children. And from there, we then, the door opened after 20 years to go into politics. I'd never thought I'd ever be going there. But, you know, the opportunity came when I began to see that systems needed to be changed. And our community said, look, you've become a voice to be able to speak into those big systems, multi-systemic systems, whether it be governmental, local, central, whether it be government departments, corporates, businesses, health, education, all of these elements that are really important. And so then for 9 years, I found myself there again, advocating and serving, taking the same principles that I was taught, which is to always go to serve. And so people said to me, well, what are you doing when you go there? And I said, I'm going to sweep the floors and make the cup of teas, you know, because that's what my electrical apprenticeship was about, was just serving. And, you know, Jerry, the powerful thing is that when you go without an agenda, a hidden agenda, but simply to serve, doors open, doors of people's hearts, doors of respect, doors where people say, well, would you like to come and learn? And that's what happened for me. The doors just kept on opening. And then eventually I became a cabinet minister and again was honored to be at the table of influence. The very thing that I'd started off from grassroots, I was now at a table where I could influence changes in our communities as well. And I was honored to be able to have that time there as well. And so that really is my life story. We now then come away from that and spent probably the last 3 to 4 years really caring for family. My mother, who's been unwell, my brother, who then eventually passed away, my mother passed away at Christmas time, you know, and my father, who also too. So it's been a season in our lives where we're now caring for the ones who cared for us when we, you know, when I was growing up and raised as well. So, yeah, so that's a bit more than 30 seconds. It's a Cook Island 30 seconds, maybe, Jerry, with a sundial.
Well, I really appreciated your opening. What was your opening? What would it translate as when you said that opening?
Well, the word kia rana doesn't mean hello. It actually means it's a blessing. So orana comes from hauora, which means well-being. You can translate it as saying, may you live long and may you live well. So it's actually a declaration of hopefulness, you know, to another person. And so really it translates as kia rana, you know, tātou katoa, that means to you, to all the people that are listening, to you, Jerry. You know, and we give honor and we give thanks, you know, to the Lord above and thank him for his blessings, really. So it's a blessing statement. Every time when we greet people in a certain way, we want to bless them. That's how we start. Mm.
And thank you for the potted history. I'm going to say to anyone listening, there's a couple of great interviews with Rodney Hyde and Paul Brennan on Reality Check Radio that will cover a lot of stuff that we won't cover probably here, Alfred. This is a more intimate and personal conversation, one where, you know, the politician can take off his hat and relax and, you know, not quite sip a glass of wine. It's a bit early in the day for that. But in the Pacifica tradition, I mean, I know in the Maori tradition here, I'm quite a newcomer. I was born in New Zealand, but I spent 58 years in England. I only came back here for my grandson about 3 years ago. So I'm learning a great deal of new stuff about New Zealand, about Maori culture, and I'm very ignorant of Pacifica culture. And I just wondered, you know, with the Maori culture, there's this kind of tradition of really checking out the ancestors before you get stuck into any kind of nitty-gritty, make sure you know where everyone's coming from and all of that stuff. What, are there any traditions like that in the Pacifica culture? Forgive my ignorance.
Yeah, so part of the migration of Pacifica, Polynesia, into, you know, the Pacific Ocean is that we're all connected. So particularly for us being Cook Island Māori, if you think about the words kia ora and kia rana, you think about the word for house, in Māori they say, in New Zealand Māori they say whare, in Cook Island Māori, they say are. So there's very strong connections in words and so forth. So the telling of the story is about your identity. To whom do you belong? Where have you come from? You know, a lot of us didn't just sort of mystically come out of nowhere. And it's a way of saying, tell us about who you are. And in other cultures, it's often about what you do rather than who you are. And so we always start off by saying, well, who are you? Who are you the son of, you know? Who's your mother? Who's your father? Who's your grandfather? Where did they come from? And so that cultural construct, that line of inquiry is actually the same for a lot of Polynesia Pacifica cultures. You know, you'll go in and whether it be Samoa, Tonga, Niue, you know, people will do the same thing too. They'll say, oh, and they'll listen to your name and then they may, and if they can't figure it from your name, they'll ask you another question about, you know, who were your parents? And then you'll tell them, oh, they belong to this island, they went to this village and so forth. And it's a very powerful way of giving a true sense of identity of who I am. Sometimes inside of that, like all things, you know, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. You know, it's the old Clint Eastwood and Lee Van Cleef movie, that Western. And I often say that, you know, it's a very good way to look at life. There are moments that we can be proud of, and there are moments that, you know, you'd say there are terrible things. And then there are things that go beyond the line of being terrible, and you could say words like they were evil. They were the true edge of trauma that have often sometimes people would choose to forget. But in our cultures, some people choose to hide it, but often there are other people who say, look, well, we're going to say it for what it is. You know, this is who we are. This is what we came from. And so identifying that is important. If I give you a quick example, my mother, who comes from the island of Mangaia, she gave me my middle name, which means Metua Kore. Metua means parent. Kore means to be without. And the reasons why she did that is that the story of, you would say in some cases, the tragedy of her upbringing, which was both her parents died when she was very young. Her mother died when she was only 8 years old. Her father died when she was 18 years old. And so they put a name so that for me, part of my story is that I have to always remember to tell my mother's story. You know, that this is what happened in her life. And so this is what, you know, part of her journey. And then it unpacks and unlocks. It's like a key or a file, for instance. It just unlocks a whole myriad of other stories that you can tell and so forth. But, yeah, so that's what happens in the culture. Identifying who you are, where you come from, you know, is important.
I think this is so important. I work with so many people and I know so many people from European traditions and culture, you know, cultures that have carried enormous trauma. And very often we find, for many of the more troubled people I work with, there's no story, there's no identity, there's no family history. The trauma has gone on for multiple generations. You know, people have, I mean, here we have in New Zealand, we have massive trauma in what has gone on, the history of people of different cultural backgrounds trying to learn how to live together. And have integrity and respect each other. That's our journey, isn't it, right now? How do we respect each other? But, you know, when I sit in my treatment room, my therapy room, and I start asking these questions about where are you from, it's amazing, Alfred, how many people can only go back. Sometimes they can't even go much to their grandparents. And I'm one of those. My family hid so much, and I've snuck around. I studied history. I guess I was always interested in finding out, you know. And you try your best to sneak into the cupboards of the past because it carries such significance for us, doesn't it? These histories are so important.
They are significant, Jerry, and important. One of the things that I've found is that guilt and shame is often what locks it in, and then it gets then removed from our history and heritage because people don't want it, whether it be by shame or guilt, no one wants to say, oh, no, this is what I happened, and I had a child out of wedlock, and, you know, or this is an illegitimate child who was given to the family because they were unwanted. You can go through, and you can all of a sudden, you hear the stories, but no one wants to tell them because of that. And then, you know, guilt and shame as an emotions, two sets of emotions, I think have caused huge amounts of trauma and have failed to allow people to unlock that to find healing. And so therefore, you know, we need to find ways to help support people to unlock that in their lives. And I think the responsibility for us in our time is that we've got to deal with these things. Because I don't want to pass on, you know, to another generation the pain that was passed on to me. And if I don't deal with what I need to be responsible for, it's irresponsible for me to allow that pain to carry on to the next generation. So now they've got to carry this. I have to find the courage inside of me to deal with my shame, my guilt, or whatever's there, or be part of helping to bring healing to brokenness. You know, and I believe that's such a powerful thing in our history and our heritage. You know, we can romance the stone. I often say to sometimes in our cultural meetings, and I said, when strangers are in the room, Jerry, we can romance the stone. Oh, you know, beautiful culture. We love it. You know, and there's such beauty. It's in the language. It's in the songs. It's in the stories that are told. It's in the celebration, you know, and an amazing aspects of it. But, you know, it's only truly amazing when we've also been able to deal with the darker side of things that hover around the edges that we don't want to talk about. And I sometimes say we need to have moments where we remove the strangers, right? And we shut the doors and we close the curtains, and now it's just us. And now let's talk about this. Let's talk about what's truly going on. Let's talk about the fact is that we've closed and we've turned a blind eye to things that we know that are abusing our children. People who are doing things that we don't want to confront them with because we would say it's not our business. It doesn't matter. When it does matter, and we have to do something about that. So, you know, I just believe that the courage, and it takes people who are willing to have courage, but you can't lead people to a place you haven't been before, Jerry. If I'm not willing to go through my journey of healing and restoration, and believe me, my wife says to me, I need a lot more of that. And I'm blessed to have been married to a psychotherapist and a counselor and a family therapist, you know, for the last 37, 38 years, where I've had all this unsolicited, and she'll probably say unpaid for, you know, counseling and therapy. But I have to say, I've been very fortunate to be able to have the moments where I can unpack these things in my life. And I just know that our family have been the better for it. And it means that when I go and work with people, help people, then I know what it means to be resilient in moments of trauma and struggle. I know what it means to hold the weight of often very difficult emotions, you know, in big settings, you know, and not be afraid, because I've dealt with my own, you know, giants or demons or things that, you know, the way we call them, you know, and that's allowed me to be able to do that. And people say to me, how did you manage to be not afraid of loud noises and big talks and people saying, you know, and just be able to sit and then allow it to, you know, emerge and then sit with it without trying to quickly, because people then say, when these things happen, oh no, let's quickly tidy it up and let's find, and everyone thinks that's the way to go, rather than saying, actually, if you don't feel the pain or if you don't feel the moment of this, then you won't find the right pathway to then bring true restoration and healing. Removing shame and guilt, helping people to come to a place of healing and restoration so that they too can go on and, you know, help restore and bless their families, their communities.
You're talking really to me of the wisdom of elders here, and the importance of having people in the room, not only who are just old by years, but old by pain, old by mistakes, old by failures. The modern version of success is so two-dimensional compared to the wisdom of elders. The gentle eyes, the nod, the silent acknowledgement, the allowance of the storminess of youth, the storminess of young men and young women, the rage that can fill us with injustice. And yet, in the middle of all of that, like the eye of the storm, we need elders. We need people that can hold this space. You know, in psychotherapy, one way of talking about it is we sometimes talk about becoming the container, being the container for the storms that our clients are experiencing. Sometimes even without saying a word, we sit and we feel the despair or the anger, and even when it's not expressed, it's kind of filling the room. And we need people in every setting, don't we, who've gone through this. And so I want to ask you something, Alfred. I don't want to be this about my reflections, but I'm so interested in what you're talking about. But what do you think you carried? You know, your parents came over here. What do you think they brought with them? What kind of traumas have you been aware of carrying in yourself because of the, I mean, yes, there's the romancing the stone, there's the beautiful culture. Many Europeans like myself, we're very envious of the strength of community and family in cultures like the Pacifica culture, the Maori culture. Did stuff come to you from your family stories? Were you, what do you think you had to carry when you got here and you were in Ponsonby and you were growing up?
Yeah, that's, wow, that's a really big question, Jerry. Yeah, look, as I said about my mother with her name, that name she gave me, you know, Mitsua Kore, you know, that was her trauma. That was her pain. And as a young girl, she ended up then not going to finishing school, and she was cleaning at home, looking after things so that her brothers could get ahead. And really that became the story of my mother's life.
You know, what does these, say those words again, the name, and what does it mean?
So Mitua Kore, Mitua, if you put it into two parts, Mitua, M-E-T-U-A, means parent. Kore means to be without. So it means, if you literally translate it, without parents. But it, the sentiment behind it is to remind that both my mum's parents were taken. So my mother recalls a story that she never got to see her mother when she died, because she died in the islands. When they die, you bury them almost the same day, right, because you don't have more. So it's a different life. It's often subsistence living in the, of the land. And so she never got to farewell her mother. You know, she never got to. So family became really important to her. So I knew that she was always carrying this. And so the trauma became like a burden. So for her, she cared for her brothers. She was always looking out for them. And so it really shaped parts of her life and the things that she did. So I sort of carried that on by then her always telling me, look after your brothers and sisters, right? And so that became almost like a, and we sort of shrouded it in a value. Oh, this is great. And it is. It's good to look after your family. But then part of it became like a burden, because you had to keep on doing things that were beyond, rather than always doing them from a place of love and support. And so, you know, that was definitely one of them. The other one was my grandmother, who had 13 children. So she had two husbands, both passed away in her lifetime. So she was a widow when she had had 10 children. And then she remarried my grandfather. And then she had three children. And then he died of pneumonia in the islands. So both her husbands died. And so being both half Jewish, she there was this mix of culture, mix of, you know, so there was lots of loud noise, debates, arguments, and but she was also very hard, right? A lot of expectations and demands and upon things. And part of it is that, you know, 13 children, two husbands, you don't have time to literally grieve in one sense. Literally, or even to try and find a sense of, well, how do I make sense of all of this? And three of her children died before she passed away. You know, so you can just see all of these things that are a part of the life. And I'd have to say that it's almost as if the essence of death became familiar. It's a strange thing to say, but it became familiar in a sense of, like, it was a welcome thing. It was just something that happened. When it happened, you just went along with that. You didn't try to overcomplicate things. You knew a cultural structure that if someone passed, what you would do to prepare, you know, all the logistics of running things, you know, services and people coming around. And but I never really felt then is that we actually stopped and talked about it, how people felt. You never, I suppose there was never really a language in a sense that had got created that I knew of, how to deal with this. And in some cases, yeah, I never learned a language of knowing how do you deal with those emotions that you feel, or were allowed to be able to have space to reflect on that or say, hey, look, just take time. And but instead, it's almost like once that had been completed, then you had to carry on with life, you know. And because in the islands, in a sense, and I suppose in a number of indigenous cultures where there was the reality of life, right? You didn't have time to, you know, once someone had passed and that grief. So I think probably the biggest trauma that I felt I carried was grief.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you so much. And I think about that. I mean, you know, it's right there, isn't it? It's placed in your middle name, the grief of your mother at eight. Losing her mother and not even really having space to process. I'm really surprised because very often, you know, we talk about indigenous cultures in the West and we kind of hold them up as something very romantic, actually. That's why I loved your expression, romancing the stone, you know, the stone of shame and guilt and hidden secrets in all families. We're not that different. You know, the Europeans are masters of hidden secrets in families. I can barely talk to someone for 10 minutes before we start unpacking all sorts of family secrets. I think we call it skeletons in the cupboard. But they're right in your name. There you are. This recognition that we must not forget the grief. We must not forget the pain, that we must process it. Even if we can't process it now, we need to pass it on in a name. So down the line, someone somewhere is going to process it. And I think it sounds like you have. I mean, I get that we've all got more to do, but you talk of some as if you're someone who has, well, the fact that you can talk of it tells me already that you've faced it, you've felt it, and to some extent you will have processed it. Am I anywhere near warm?
Yeah, you are. You're pretty hot, really, and in a sense of... that's exactly what's happened. And yeah, like I said, and then for my brother, my older brother, he was only 56 when he died. Five children died of a heart attack. And the cry of a mother of losing their firstborn child is a cry you don't want to hear. And there I was, and she cried this deep longing for the child that had come from her womb, right? The very first child she gave birth to. You know, it's to go through that and then to see mum herself, you know, in the next, to be honest, the next 3 years, mum never really recovered. Every day she cried for him. Every day, you know, in her room, she would just cry. And so she never got over that in one sense. So, you know, for me, I had to then journey through my mother passing as well as my brother, and taking them through that, and then having space, you know, just to then deal with it myself. And so, and it meant that for my other family members, I was able to be there for them, you know, because a lot of times people struggled. And, you know, both life and death, you know, the birthing of life and the death of life in particular, you know, can emerge all sorts of emotions from people, you know, where people want to deny that it even happened and or that it was happening in some cases, yeah.
Well, I'm fascinated because I'm looking at the bookshelf behind you and I'm seeing the seven candles of the, is it called the menorah?
Yes, it's a menorah, yeah.
And you said that you had also, now was it the grandmother who had 13 children who was half Jewish? Mm. Was she the mother of your mother or was she the mother of your father?
Yes, she was the mother of my father. And it's interesting because I've spoken to rabbis and, you know, in the synagogue and talked about how the transition of change where it's now become, you know, on the maternal side that people recognize whether you're Jewish or not in one sense. But then you've got others that would argue on how it doesn't matter as long as there's a descendancy of blood, you know, line that's in there. So, yeah, so it was my grandmother. Her name was Rita, or they call it Rite, and her father's name was Goldstein. So, you know, you can't get any more Jewish than that, you know, with a name like Goldstein.
And how on earth does a Pacific Islander end up being half Jewish? Tell me that story.
Yeah, it's an amazing story because so her father was called Marcus Goldstein. So he was a Polish Jew. And as you know, there was the pogroms that were happening. The Russians at that time were obviously attacking a lot of the Jewish communities in Poland, you know, and throughout the parts of Europe. And so he was one of those that went to England first and then jumped on a boat and then was heading down to New Zealand and stopped in the Pacific and stopped in Rarotonga. And then somehow got a passage to Aitutaki, which is where my great-grandmother is. And then he married my great-grandmother, Te Piri Ariki. Fell in love with her, and then he had two daughters, one that passed and one that lived, and the one that lived was my grandmother. So yeah, so it's an amazing story about how it all happened. And so she had blonde hair and sparkly sort of greeny hazel eyes, you know, and that was my grandmother. Mm.
Wow, it's mind-boggling, isn't it? The intercultural connections here. I'm just thinking, forgive me for being a bit dim here, but didn't the boat go a bit off course if it ended up what route did it go?
Well, the thing is that actually Rarotonga became one of those trade routes you could come down, and so you go through to Australia and then you can come off course. And we're piecing parts of the story about, because it's a good question, how did he end up coming into Rarotonga? But there are a number of people that often would stop off into Rarotonga to refuel and get extra supplies and then make their way down to New Zealand. So it was one of the trade routes.
They would have come through the Panama Canal, wouldn't they, doing that?
Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know exactly, but all I know is that he found a way there.
Do we know what year that happened when your great-grandfather Goldstein? What year are we talking about, do you think?
Yes. So my grandmother was born at the turn of the century of the night. So she was born in 1900. And so he came there, in my understanding, in 1890. You know, he landed in the – so, you know, we're talking, you know, these early times that he was travelling. But, you know, it's like everywhere. You've got people, strange people who come from all sorts of different places, right? They end up on boats and they, you know, and so we're still trying to piece that other part of the story, and we're using, I've got another auntie who's looking at some of the marine through the shipping logs to try and track his name going back further as well. Yeah, fascinating, eh? Just... And in my grandmother, then all of her, a lot of the children, like a number of them have the name Marcus, a number of them have the name Rita or Rite. And for me, my daughter's middle name has got Rite after my grandmother, and my our youngest son is called Shalom. Wow. You know, which actually comes from the root name Shalem, which means to be whole. You know, it's not just about it's peacefulness, it's... So he completed our four children, even though I did try to go for nine. But anyway, my wife hoodwinked me, because I'd said to her, can we have nine children? Yeah. Got to four. She said, no, that's it. We're stopping now. We've had enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking to Alfred Ngaro on Real People in the Psychotherapist Chair, and we're diving deep today. We're talking about our roots, and this program's all about what unites us. And one of the things that I think unites us is actually trauma. One of the things you can guarantee that humans will do to each other, at least in this world, is that they're going to give each other grief. And we say that, don't we? We give grief. And grief is often something that is tucked away under the carpet by humans. I regard grieving as the holy grail of my work. The pure gold of psychotherapy is when we reach the stage of grieving. You know, you can have your anger, and I appreciate and understand your anger, and you can have your fear, and you can have your anxiety, and you can have your depression. But until we get to the core grief, the healing is only partial. And that moment of sharing grief you described, goodness, it really touched me. I was tearing up when you talked about your mother and her grief when your brother died. And that picture of you witnessing her grief, which will have been for her son, but it will also have been stirring up older griefs, her own mother, her 8-year-old grief, will all have been in there. And I think of you caring for her, Alfred. And right there, you have the very essence of healing to me, which is humans caring for each other so that none of this has to be done alone. And I don't know where I'm going with this, except to say, what do you think helped you get through most, more than anything? What helped you through the traumas that you carried from your families that you were aware of, but also the traumas of your own life? You've had a few. You've had a big disappointment, really. I was rooting for you. I was so hoping New Zeal would get in. I was thinking, man, if we could get this Alfred fella in Parliament again, coming from where he's coming, that would be a really good thing for New Zealand. And I love the title, but you've had your own upsets and disappointments, I'm sure. But what helps you the most? What helps you get through your trauma? How do you cope with it?
So one of the things that I was raised with my grandmother was learning to pray, really. And all my time is that I'd wake up in the morning, my grandmother was praying. I'd go to sleep at night with her because I was raised by her till I was about 7. She'd be praying. And prayer is beyond just, we give it a human word of being religious, but it's a spiritual element of deep reflection of everything around you, your world, your values, your beliefs, and so forth. And so, you know, every time she would be praying for me and with me and teaching me how to do that. And prayer then was a key part of faith. And I realized that it taught me how to reflect. In a prayer, it's a great reflection, you know. And we all often pray the Lord's Prayer in English and in Māori, Cook Island Māori. You know, E tō mātou mitu o te ao, our Father who art in heaven. All of a sudden it stops you and you begin to reflect on who you are. There's a sense of belonging that's there. And you begin to go through this process. It gave me a process of how to break things down. And in the middle of that grief, I needed that. I needed to know what it is to be able to give me just some simple steps in knowing how to deal with it. You know, our Father in heaven, holy is your name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, you know, on earth as it is in heaven. And so now you've got this bigger sense of belonging. You know, give us this day our daily bread. And so you're going through. So there are needs that we have that we can't, and we've got nowhere else to go to. So we ask that you would give them to us. Needs of resilience, needs of love, needs that, you know, and that terminology of the container in psychotherapy, you know, in the prayer talks about it's like a cup, a container, that you would fill a cup to overflowing. And so the importance is that it teaches you go to the places that fill your cup, because often when your cups become empty, you can't give out of emptiness. And when we do, it has a hollow sound and feeling to it. But we can only give when we are full. So what is it that fills our cup? What is it that gives me that? And so, you know, the love of my family and my children, you know, it reminds me about that. Don't forget, you know, these words are really important to how you deal with it. And so that was really the first thing that helped, and I would say the thing that's helped me the most to be able to, you know, deal with the grief. You know, when my grandmother passed away, you know, she was quite significant, you know, to me in my life, and to be able to be there, you know, I remember being at the edge of the grave, and they just buried my grandmother, and it just began to pour down with rain. And of course, everyone ran to the cars. And yet I just sat there and knelt on the ground, and I just wept. And I just wept and wept, and I thought about all that she had taught me, and everyone had gone. And I just, and for me, that was part of my grieving. I had to just sit there, you know, and just remember and just honor her. But, you know, in the rain, my heart was pouring out. And so, and I remember what she had taught me. And so for me, it was, you know, the power of prayer is the power to reflect. It's a power to remember. It's a power to give you some stepping stones to find a way out. so you're not stuck in this darkness at times, and to be able to unlock that. And so really that, I would say, Jerry, is probably be the way that I've been able to get through that for me, yeah.
I'm pausing here because what you've said deserves a bit of silence. Well, bless you, Alfred, and bless your mother and your grandmother and all your ancestors. They do live in you and you honor them. And it's clear from when I talk with you that you carry a great weight for New Zealand and for New Zealanders. You rarely touched on the stuff I know you've done. But go listen to Paul and Rodney Hyde's interviews with you, because you talk a lot more about that stuff. But I know that you've done stuff. We talk about carrying the burden, but not having to carry it alone. When you talk of prayer, the feature for me as a Christian is that I carry the burden to my prayer, and then I can hand it over. And that is so essential. Sometimes I weep in my prayer time because, you know, my work is around a lot of suffering. People don't, you know, spend a lot of money and time with a psychotherapist unless they've got a real reason to do that. And there's trauma and pain in there that I meet and I work with. And sometimes it does rub off, no matter how good the training, no matter how professional I am. I'm a human being hearing of some terrible things that people did to each other or stuff they didn't do. And in all of that, in my prayer, sometimes I just weep. But I know I'm not alone. And that means everything to me. I guess I regard Christ as the greatest therapist ever.
Yeah, I you know, and I was reflecting on that. I remember that the other day I was just reading Psalm 139, which, as you know, is a collection of David's poems, right? And he wrote these poems, and the power in Psalm 139 just reminds us that, you know, that we've got a purpose, and the great love of a Father. You know, that all the days ordained for us have already been written. And
say that again. I didn't catch it all.
Oh, so Psalm 139 says, you know, all the days ordained for us, you know, all the days that have been planned for us, everything that had been purposed in our life. It's like, you know, your desire was to go to see your three-year-old grandson at his three-year-old birthday. And you look into him. And as a grandfather, I imagine you would be thinking of all the things that you would desire for him in his life, that he would live a great life, not just a good life, but a great life. And that he's the legacy you and I leave behind. It's our grandchildren, right? And you look at him, and I think about that psalm because it's the psalm that, like, of a father or a grandfather, that, you know, what we wish for them, ordain for them, is that they would live the full potential in their life. And that, you know, I really want to honor your show and what you're doing, because whether we're three-year-old, 13, 23, 30, even 60, it doesn't matter how old we are. Sometimes we need keys, right? We need a set of tools that help us to unlock things that happen to us, because we live in a fallen world where, unfortunately, even bad things happen to good people. And how do you help them? How do you help your grandchild, your grandson, you know, to have a set of tools? And the first thing I would say, because I know it's for my own grandson, just to tell him I love him every day. And every time when we see each other, he comes and he gives me this huge hug, you know, and he just says, I love you, Papa, you know. And when he leaves, he says exactly the same thing. And that's because I've said that. And so what I've given to him is, and we can all do it, is the fact is that he will know, no matter what happens in his life, he will always know that he's been loved and he is deeply loved. And you know, it's one of the things that I believe are important that we can give to our people and to our family, you know, to our children, and is the way of knowing then when these things happen, when this grief and this trauma happens, you know, how can they find a set of tools? How can they have some ways of being able to find our way out by being loved by the ones around us, by having faith, you know, as an important part? And that's why I said faith, family, and future were the three pillars that I was raised on. You know, and I have to say, Jerry, that everywhere I've been, whether it be on a board of trustees for a school, my children's local school, whether it be on advisory committees for a council around housing, or whether it be at Parliament, you know, and being a cabinet minister, you know, those three elements are core. And people would say to me, oh, you know, don't leave your religion. This is about politics. And I say to them this, I said, read your history. And they look at me, oh, what do you mean? I said, know your history. And I remember it came one day because one of the things when I was going through the lobby and they've got these bookshelves and it's got, since Parliament began, every single speech that's been made, they call it the Hansards, right? It's the recording of every word that's spoken in Parliament. And the very first Hansard I felt one day when I was praying, and here I was praying early hours of the morning, just praying around, reflecting. And at 5 a.m. in the morning, I was in there on my own, and I felt to go up and grab the Hansard out. And on the 24th of May in 1854, when Parliament in New Zealand first began, what I realized, the very first debate was about prayer, you know, and they realized that, you know, it was a time in which the morals and values of a country, people realized that there's only one thing that can help us, that we need divine God. And that's what they argued for 2 hours. They debated what would be the formation of their prayer, and basically came down to putting aside personal interests, right? In other words, when I come here to serve. We beseech thee. In other words, that old English word of we cry out to you that you would give us divine guidance, that we would lead the affairs of this house, you know, with justice and righteousness. You know, in other words, do the right thing. One is what you call living out the values in your life, and the other one's upholding, you know, the laws that protect us. And so all of these elements were part of that. And so the power of prayer, even in politics, right? It's the reminder. It's not the telling you how to, but what it is, it's giving you a set of guidelines about your attitude, your behavior, a set of values to conduct your affairs. Now, did they always do that right? No. But embedded inside of that are so many things that are important. The Magna Carta of 800 years obviously was because of the fact of a king who'd gone too far, right? A malevolent king who decided he wanted to rule and reign. And what this did now is brought the equity of accountability for all people, whether you were the king, the nobles, or the peasants. And so the Magna Carta was used, and we use the Westminster form of governance. Where does Westminster come from? It comes from the Westminster form of confession. So people don't realize, and there's a Westminster confession, and there's a prayer. It's a prayer that's there. It just reminds us of these things. So the truth is, when we know it personally, it can impact everything we do, even professionally, in what we do. And we need to stop saying, oh, no, leave that behind. No, you know it isn't. You have to carry it with you. And my elders would say to us, you know, spirituality is not what you do at a time and a place. It's the first breath you take in the morning. The word tihe Māori ora means the breath of life. And so when you get up in the morning, you stop and you give thanks for the breath of life. I'm still alive. Thank you, Lord. I can live another day. You know, it's how you conduct yourself. You know, so these values are how you conduct in the relationships around you. And if you do make mistakes, you know, there's a way to restore that brokenness is a thing called forgiveness, right? Go and ask for forgiveness. Apologize. You know, so all of these things are important. So these values are just, when we live it personally, then we can live it professionally very easily. Yeah.
Oh, well, we've run out of time, Alfred, and that was just beautiful, because what a lovely way to end, to hear of the spirituality of politics. This is not a subject we hear a great deal about, you know, and knowing you and knowing your journey, even to the small amount that I do, I truly believe that New Zealand would be blessed were you to be back in Parliament And were you to step up and be able to take that burden, because it's an enormous burden. And I've heard you talk about how the family suffered and how you're absent so much. And well, bless you for all your service. I just want to say that. I just feel so honored to spend time with you, to have the privilege of spending time hearing your take on culture. I mean, I guess if you do become prime minister, maybe we could get together and we could declare a year of grieving. So the whole of New Zealand stops and it just grieves and lets go of the wounds of the past. And then we move on and we'll be a great nation for it. We'll be together. We'll be brothers and sisters. That would be, yeah, give me a call and then we'll do something like that, eh? But yeah, lovely to talk to you. You've been listening to real people, people of service. In the psychotherapist chair with me, Jerry Powers, and we've been blessed with listening to the thoughts and life of Alfred Ngaro. Alfred, thank you so much. It just has been such a profound and insightful experience to talk with you. You've changed me in this conversation.
Thank you, Jerry, and thank you so much. And I want to honor you and thank you for what you're doing. Which you're the first I've ever heard of a psychotherapist having a show, in a sense that would also help to bring healing and restoration for people in our communities. What a wonderful thing to be able to do. And thank you for the way you are serving us in our communities. It's such an honor. So, you know, blessings upon you and your family. I can see the smile that you have for your grandson, and then how that, you know, he brought you from the other side of the world, right? He holds a peace in your heart. It's so important, and I guarantee he knows it, that even as young as he is, he knows the love of his grandfather and grandmother that came back for him. What a wonderful story that he'll be totally be telling. Did you know that my grandpa came all the way from England? What do you mean he came? He came all the way, drove all the way down because he wanted to be here for me. That's a, you know, you've now created a moment that's a memory that, you know, will be, you know, something that he loves as well. So thank you for that. And thank you for doing this for us. You know, I want to say that you're doing it not only just for me and for other people, but, you know, being able to have that moment where you say, you're giving people permission that it's okay. You know, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to share your story. And more importantly, that you can find healing and restoration and love and peace in your heart. So, you know, the Lord bless you.
Well, thank you so much, Alfred. And, you know, right back at you, as they say. In that conversation with Alfred, there was a lot of talk, wasn't there, about trauma. And I thought I'd talk a little bit more about trauma, but particularly what we can do and how we can deal with it and how we can minimize the impact that trauma can have on our life. I actually wrote a book about trauma, and that book was about how we can all use touch, ordinary human touch, to soothe the nervous system and give the trauma that is stored in the body a physical and kinetic pathway to leave the body. I believe a great deal of trauma is stored in our nervous system because modern life does not allow it to discharge into the environment, into the earth, into the air, as it once used to in traditional societies. So we need to get very smart about how we deal with trauma. And that's what I want to focus on today in my reflections. So let's get one thing clear right from the off, right from the get-go. Trauma's normal. Trauma is really a part of life. If we don't have any trauma, and by that I'm also including some stress, if we don't have trauma and stress, then we probably don't learn much in life. Just think about how going through traumatic times actually helps us to grow and build our personality and our character. You know, I can think of one example from my own life where I let a friend down, and I was only 7 at the time, so I do forgive myself, and I was being two-faced. I said one thing to one friend and another thing to another. And when that friend found out, they wouldn't talk to me. Well, I was devastated. This had been a good buddy for a long time. I was only 7 years old, don't forget. So 2 years of a buddy is, you know, a lot of life. 2/7 of a life, probably 3/7, which is close to half in my maths. And so when that happened to me, I felt awful. And I went through all sorts of reactions and upsets. But you know what? I learned to be a loyal friend from that. I learned that no matter how hard it was to speak truth and to stand by a friend when times are tough, that was the right and good thing to do. So trauma has a lot to teach us about our mistakes, about what we learn from life. And don't listen to any of that rubbish about big T trauma and little T trauma. There's no scientific evidence whatsoever that some traumas are by definition small and some traumas are large. All the research says, you know what, if you're traumatized and you're triggered, your full body goes into trauma. No big T or little T about it. Anyone who talks about that is talking out of the wrong end of their digestive system, in my very humble opinion. What the scientific research shows us, without a shadow of a doubt, is that if we're triggered and traumatized by whatever, and even when we learn from it, the lessons that we may need to learn, the nervous system is carrying the shock and the charge of that trauma. And we talk about fight and flight and freeze and flop, actually. We talk about when freeze has done its freezing bit and we get exhaustion and we flop. And that's where a lot of chronic illnesses come from. You see, there is a definite physical element to this trauma, no matter how emotional. And, you know, not all trauma is just a big physical event either. You know, you've got the trauma of war or a car accident or abuse. But then you've also got the other traumas that are much more hidden. For example, growing up with an alcoholic father. Not talking about anyone in particular here, you understand. But growing up with an alcoholic father who you never knew how he would react. One of the features of alcoholism is a volatile and unreliable emotional state. Well, of course, because the body is flooded with toxic chemicals. Every single day, growing up, not knowing whether something you do or say is going to get you a violent attack or a smile or even a cuddle. That puts you on edge. Some people grow up with that as children and then enter into relationships where they are treated like that or gaslit, as the expression goes. You see, what we know with certainty is that however we dealt with it, trauma has a physiological impact. It's a physical experience to the nervous system. It's like a shock. And that might be a little needling daily traumatic shock, or it might be one enormous big shock. But imagine trauma as an electrical charge. And we might learn from it, and we might move on, and we survive through it. Yes, I get all of that. But what happens to that electrical charge of the original trauma? And our reactions to it, our fight, flight, fright, fight, flight, freeze, or flop. Well, it sits there. And just because we don't see it and we're not in those active fight, flight, and freeze responses, does it go away? I don't think so. Right from the beginning of psychoanalysis, Freud thought of trauma as electrical energy. And we haven't really had a good reason to think otherwise. And psychoanalysts and psychotherapists, we talk about what do we do with that energy? And a lot of mental health comes down to our nervous system carrying high charge of trauma. The anxious and the depressed person shows the same brain scan as someone who's traumatized. The blood flees from the prefrontal cortex, where we do all our processing and rational thinking and problem solving. And it goes to the reactive emotional parts, the fight, flight, and freeze parts of the brain, which actually some of that is right in the brainstem. It's not under our conscious control. If we're accumulating this trauma, it's still there, but it's not active. So I call it ambient trauma. And we can accumulate ambient trauma without even realizing it. And one of the things that came up in my conversation with Alfred was this idea of transgenerational trauma. And we talked of how his own family background carried a lot of trauma for his mother and his grandmother. And there may be trauma that we're carrying that we don't even know about. Now, Alfred was incredibly well aware of past family traumas. But many of us grew up in families that didn't want to talk about trauma. When a member of a family has gone through extreme trauma, they generally don't talk about it. They don't want to inflict it on everyone around them. It's a kind of heroic silence, misplaced, but heroic nonetheless. And when you think about this, how could we possibly carry trauma when we don't know about it? Well, here's the thing. When your mother was in your grandmother's womb, your grandmother's experience were being translated directly to the carried fetus. And in your mother's fetal body, pre-birth body, one of the eggs that is you was already there. In other words, the egg cell that formed and from which you grew was in your mother's body whilst your grandmother was carrying her. So your grandmother's trauma was transmitted directly through your mother to you before your mother was even born. And that's just one way in which generations transfer trauma from one generation to the next. And there are studies on survivors of the Holocaust and their children and their grandchildren. And it's very clear that the health outcomes from people who have got a traumatic transgenerational history, and by the way, we probably all do have some of that, fare worse. So the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors have all sorts of health problems that the control groups don't. But there are many ways in which trauma gets passed down. Patterns of parenting and how families operate are passed down. Family systems, what we call script in transactional analysis, my psychotherapy. So what do we do with all of this? I mean, do we just kind of get a shovel and start digging ourselves a grave and give up? No. But we do have to get smarter. The more modern life takes us away from the nature and natural ways of discharging trauma out of our nervous system. You know, we're not walking bare feet as much. Here in New Zealand, there's more bare feet walking than anywhere else in the world I've lived. But there may be other places as well. But what I'm saying here is traditional indigenous society, whilst it carried its many traumas, also carried its many opportunities for discharge that are not available in modern life. If you live in Auckland and you go to work in Auckland, how often can you walk barefoot on the earth? I could go on, but what have we got today? Well, it means today we have to double up, quadruple up, actually, on the activities we do that are likely to allow discharge from our nervous system. Walking in nature is one of them, barefoot if possible. But we also have to think about how well we're breathing. We have to give ourselves more rest than ever before, in my opinion. We must make sure more than ever before that we spend time around good people. We have to be much more careful about what we eat. In general, I would say that what 20 years ago required an awareness two or three times a week now requires an awareness two or three times a day just for survival, because trauma has been deliberately stimulated in us right across social media, right across media. Trauma has been specifically induced by governments. People, psychologists and psychotherapists like me, have sold their souls to the devil and earned their money advising governments on how to stimulate fear in the population, because a fearful population is easy to control. And how do you stimulate fear? You up the ante of trauma. So we've got to get really, really smart at discharging the trauma. Now, one of the smartest ways I've come across is one developed by me after 40 years of bodywork and psychotherapy. And you can access that for free on my website, www.jerrypives.com. And you'll be able to access a free series of training videos that will teach you how, with one other person, you can literally remove the trauma from each other's nervous system through touch. Very specific, but very natural touch, done clothed. It's not massage. It's touch designed to work on the nervous system. My wife and I plan to come round and teach it in person to people. My wife was instrumental in helping me develop this. But you don't have to wait for me to get my stuff together. I keep threatening it, but it doesn't happen. It will happen, I promise you. But meanwhile, you can just go and get these videos that show you, they're taught, they take you through. You and your partner could learn it in a day. But my main point here is that we have to quadruple the amount of effort we make to ensure that our nervous system can continually release and discharge trauma, trauma that we're not even aware of, trauma that is being psychologically generated by government-paid demons of psychology, the people in my profession who have sold their soul. So you need a few of us, psychotherapists and psychologists, who understand what demonic games are being played to support you. And all you need to do is to manage your own nervous system, meditation, nature, all the things I've mentioned. Only now you need to think of yourself as doing that 3 or 4 times a day. Look at your day and say, when am I with good people? When am I in nature? When am I allowing my body to sleep and rest? Or if I'm struggling with sleep, when do I just allow myself to rest with beautiful music? And so on and so forth. You know the gig. The most important thing, though, is getting the context right. And the context is transgenerational trauma. The context is ambient trauma. And the context is GIT, which is government-induced trauma. But wherever the trauma is coming from, it may well be sitting in your nervous system. How do we know that? Very simple. The more reactive we become, the less functional our mind becomes, the more brain fog, the more we get to be dysfunctional and not be able to operate the way we used to, the more trauma we're carrying. The solution to that is to discharge the trauma. Good luck with it, and I'll be back next week with some more reflections.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day and life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.